From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Less than 2 weeks after agreeing to a ceasefire with Hamas militants in Gaza, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is fighting for his political life. A coalition of opposition politicians is working on a deal that would oust Netanyahu from power and form a new government. His former protege, Naftali Bennett, has until midnight tomorrow to get it done. Neri Zilber is a journalist and analyst with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He joins us now from Tel Aviv. And Neri, where do things stand now? How close is the prime minister from losing power ahead of that deadline?
Well, he's quite close. So the opposition parties are currently still negotiating the final details of this this coalition government that's supposed to replace Netanyahu. It's about 8 p.m. local time right now. And as you mentioned, they have until tomorrow midnight. That's the deadline to get it done. They're optimistic they can get it done. They were hoping to get it done by today. It's looking like it's dragging a little bit, but it's really the final details for what everybody believes will be a alternative government.
Tell me more about Naftali Bennett and this coalition that he's trying to form, which, you know, actually spans a pretty wide spectrum of political beliefs.
So it's interesting. So Bennett himself is a hard right ideologue. He's the head of a pro-settler party, Yamina, which means rightward. And as you mentioned, he started off as an aide to Netanyahu, and he went off and formed his own party several years ago, and really has been a stalwart ally of the prime minister, even though that relationship oftentimes wasn't reciprocated by Netanyahu. And he's set to join with various centrist parties, primarily led by opposition leader Yair Lapid, who is officially the one tasked with forming a government currently, as well as other right-wing factions and even perhaps an Arab-Israeli Islamist party. So really, from left pro-peace parties to hard-right pro-settler parties and everything in the middle, it'll be a very heterogeneous coalition, unlike anything Israel has seen before. But the one thing keeping them together and hopefully getting this deal done in their minds is the prospect of finally unseating Netanyahu after 12 straight years in power.
Right. So what happened and how did it happen so quickly? Because it was really just a few days ago when the bombs were still flying between Hamas and Israel that analysts were saying that the conflict itself would help solidify Netanyahu's political future. It doesn't look like that worked out to be true.
Right. So I even reported at the time, and I think I came on the show and said as much, that really one of the victors from the Gaza war was Netanyahu, at least politically, and that Bennett, in the midst of the fighting, had actually taken the prospect of an alternative government, change government, as they call it here, off the table. He seems to have reversed himself in recent days, primarily for two reasons. Number one, really, Netanyahu didn't have the votes, didn't have the numbers in parliament for an alternative government, a right-wing government that would have included Naftali Bennett. And number two, Bennett made a core promise publicly that he would do everything to avoid yet another election, a fifth election in the span of two and a half years here in Israel. And he said it as much on Sunday. He gave a primetime address to the nation, kind of outlining his thinking. And he said, you know, we have to stop the madness. We have to stop this this political crisis, and that it was time to take responsibility, even though politically it seems like Bennett will pay a cost amongst his right-wing base, who is quite angry, at least in large part, that he's actually breaking from Netanyahu.
Right, and it sounds like that's what Netanyahu is trying to focus on here, saying that Bennett is betraying supporters on the right. And we know, if you've been following Benjamin Netanyahu for any amount of time, you know he's not going to go down without a fight. What is he doing to destabilize support for this new government?
That's right. Netanyahu is nothing if not a fighter, at least for his own purposes. And he's doing everything possible to apply pressure on Bennett and Bennett's party and other potential right-wing members of this future coalition to get them to wilt, to cave. And he's been calling it, you know, this prospective government, a dangerous left-wing government for the future of the country. Various Netanyahu allies and mouthpieces have been calling Bennett and others traitors, no more, no less. You had a parliamentarian from Netanyahu's party saying this wasn't a transfer of power. This was a theft of power, stealing of power, very reminiscent of other political transitions in recent memory. So he's really trying to apply public pressure from the right-wing base on these various right-wing politicians ahead of next week's formal swearing-in in Parliament of this potential government. It remains to be seen whether it succeeds, but it's really his only shot.
Well, look, if this new government does form and it includes so many politicians that would typically oppose each other, what would governing look like? Will anything get done?
That is the good, you know, the big question that everyone's asking. I think in their minds, and they've even said it publicly, they're trying to return some semblance of stability and normalcy to political life in Israel. To tackle, you know, long-standing and deep-seated issues, but consensual issues. So things like economy and passing a budget, things like education and health. What they likely won't touch on, or will try not to touch on, are more controversial issues like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and settlements in the West Bank, and even potentially in future another Gaza campaign. But really, they don't seem to have another alternative other than coming together, again, for the sole purpose of ending Netanyahu's reign. What comes after, they figure, has to be better.
Yeah. All right, we're going to keep a close eye on this. Neri Zilber, journalist and analyst with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Federal agriculture officials are monitoring a type of bat in Mexico. It's called a vampire bat because it lives solely off of other animals' blood. One species can transmit rabies, and that's concerning agricultural officials because the bats like to feast on the blood of farm animals. Now, we have yet to spot them here in the U.S., but because of climate change, that may soon change, particularly in areas like cattle-rich Florida. Jessica Mazaros from member station WUSF in Tampa reports.
That's what a vampire bat colony sounds like. And this is the sound of their prey. There are three species of vampire bats that feast on the blood of large animals like cattle, and only one species that can carry rabies. They reside mainly in Latin America right now, but Tony Piaggio, a scientist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, says that could soon change.
What we found is that there's a clear signal of population expansion on the northern end of their distribution, specifically in Mexico.
Piaggio says vampire bats don't typically migrate, but rising temperatures from global warming are creating more habitat for them to the north. And an increase of development in their native habitat also has the creatures on the move. So far, there have been no reports of vampire bats in the U.S., but experts believe the first place they'll show up is southern Texas. Florida is also on the list. Piaggio says the bats could be blown in by storms or catch a ride on a shipping container.
The biggest concern about vampire bats and livestock is the transmission of pathogens, and specifically rabies. And this is a problem in Mexico and Central America and South America.
Piaggio says the livestock industry in those areas can spend millions of dollars vaccinating for rabies. Luis Lecuona is also with the USDA. He's based in Mexico City, working with officials on wildlife diseases there.
The risk of the transmission of rabies to the cattle is a huge and important impact in the economy.
He says if young, unvaccinated animals become infected with rabies, they will die.
In fact, that is one of the main indicatives that the vampires are present in an area.
And for some small-scale ranchers, livestock deaths could be financially devastating. Lecuona says Mexico has launched national campaigns to vaccinate cattle and other farm animals in affected areas. He says they also have some monitoring and education programs in place. About 20 years ago, Lecuona says vampire bats were recorded in 25 Mexican states. Right now, they are in 27 states, including Nuevo León, which is close to the Texas border. Back in September of last year, Tony Piaggio says the USDA held a virtual panel of federal and state employees to start strategizing around the possibility of vampire bats entering this country.
Everybody thought it was about a 60% chance that within the next 20 years, there could be a vampire bat documented, but that doesn't necessarily inherently mean anything that is something to be concerned about.
The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission took part in that discussion. In an email, a spokesperson says, right now, it's unclear whether the creatures will make it to Florida, but agency officials plan to keep working with the USDA and are open to establishing vampire bat monitoring programs if needed. Pasco County cattle rancher Kevin Escobar has not yet heard about vampire bats within his circles, but he says it's good that officials are keeping an eye on the future health of the cattle industry.
As things continue to evolve and grow, there will always be new changes that we have to adapt to in order to keep our herds healthy, to provide a safe and healthy food supply for the consumer.
So that's the story regarding cattle. But what about people? Should we be worried? Experts say no, vampire bats aren't really interested in humans. There are exceptions, of course. Just don't plan to sleep outdoors at night in areas with a high volume of the nocturnal creatures. For Here and Now, I'm Jessica Mazaros in Tampa.
On Venice Beach in L.A., there's this brick wall by the water where taggers write all kinds of messages for people walking by to see. The other day, I happened upon Andrew Patilano in the midst of spray painting a message unlike all the others. It was about MDMA, also known as Molly or Ecstasy. It says, MDMA cures PTSD.
I feel passionate about it in particular because I think that a lot of these compounds could have been studied a lot more, and it's a crime that they are Schedule 1 compared to more dangerous compounds like alcohol.
Patilano, in addition to being an artist, is also a chemistry professor. He's always thinking about compounds. So he says he was excited to read the latest study published in Nature magazine on the first major trial on the effectiveness of using MDMA to help treat post-traumatic stress disorder. Researchers say the initial findings are promising, but the study of MDMA has always come up against cultural stigmas. As a party drug back in the 2000s, ER doctors saw a dramatic increase in ER visits. But under medical supervision, the authors of this study say MDMA could prove beneficial. Joining us now is Jennifer Mitchell, a neuroscientist at the University of California, San Francisco, and a lead author on this study. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with what this study's treatment looks like. It's important to note that it isn't just MDMA on its own. It's paired with a therapist providing intensive counseling. Can you walk us through a patient's experience?
Sure. So in short, the subject, the participant, undergoes a series of preparatory sessions prior to ever being administered the MDMA. And then for a full day, they take the MDMA in a treatment room that looks a lot like a nice living room. And then they return the following day for an integration session. And about a month later, they repeat that process. And then about a month later, they repeat it again. And it's a particularly inner guided therapy process. So it is manualized, and you're not prompting the participant a lot with questions. You're not asking them to explore certain aspects of their past or their trauma. You're letting the medicine and the participant lead the way.
How efficacious was this study? What did you find?
We found that individuals that received MDMA in addition to therapy experienced significantly greater reduction in PTSD symptoms and also in their symptoms of depression. So they were not actually need to necessarily be depressed to enroll in this study. But as a secondary measure, we found that the MDMA successfully treated their depression as well.
Well, PTSD has a range of traumas. There's combat traumas we talked often about with veterans' experiences, but also racial trauma and childhood trauma. How were patients selected for the study?
They self-referred to the study, and we took all types of trauma, all different walks of life. One of the things that we were sort of most intrigued by and perhaps most impressed by was the finding that MDMA was equally effective in some of those subgroups, which are typically considered treatment resistant because their trauma is so extreme.
Well, let's talk more about that. Your study marks a turning point in getting approval from the Food and Drug Administration for this kind of treatment. There have been other studies of psychedelics trying to treat depression with magic mushrooms, as they're commonly known. What is it about MDMA that primes the brain for therapy?
Well, we do still need to do a lot more investigative work in human models. In animals, it's pretty clear that MDMA has an impact on a brain region called the amygdala, where fear memories are typically stored and retrieved. And so we are assuming that there is a similar process going on in humans and that the MDMA allows them access to memories that are very traumatic in nature and very hard to address or focus on, perhaps without a lot of shame and a lot of fear, and that somehow the MDMA is enabling people to take a look at those memories in a way that isn't uncomfortable to them, and that allows them to work with the therapy team to process and release them.
You know, part of all of this is overcoming the stigma and criminalization of psychedelics. You know, often MDMA, often known as Molly and ecstasy, is thought of as a party drug in a lot of people's minds. Although many places like Oregon and D.C. has sought to decriminalize them and it has gone so far to do so, where do you think your work fits into changing the cultural perception of these drugs?
Well, my hope is that this work represents a first step towards people perhaps being willing to consider taking another look at these compounds and perhaps a more objective look than what happened back in the 60s and 70s in the United States, at least. And that maybe it also opens the door to additional studies of other, you know, psychedelic therapeutics.
Did you find any downsides during this study? Any possibly groups of people who should not consider this kind of treatment?
One of the issues with this study is that individuals had to taper off all of their other psychiatric medications to participate so that we could see what the MDMA was actually doing. And I think that was destabilizing for a lot of people that then couldn't, that because there's a placebo arm in this study, that then didn't mm-hmm. get the MDMA. And so thankfully the study sponsor is addressing that and we're crossing those individuals over and they will have an opportunity to receive the active drug now.
The chemist that I spoke with at Venice Beach went on to tell me how his father died of alcoholism, and he wonders if his father had guided treatment like MDMA therapy, if his father would actually still be alive. I'm sure you've heard these kinds of stories before.
Absolutely, and they're heartbreaking, and that's one of the reasons why we're so determined to come up with novel therapeutics for PTSD. There's so many people that are suffering. I think we could do better.
That was Jennifer Mitchell, neuroscientist at the University of California, San Francisco, and lead author on the first phase 3 study on using MDMA to assist therapy in treating PTSD. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Kanu Kaplash is one of the patients who participated in the 2018 study while an undergrad at the University of Connecticut. He received the drug instead of the placebo. And Kaplash is going to take us through what this therapy looks, sounds, and feels like. And we want to take note that Kaplash will be describing his experiences as part of this study. This is not an endorsement of the drug. Kaplash tells us he signed up for the study as a last resort after trying and failing under traditional forms of therapy.
When the topic is, you know, stuff like sexual assault or, you know, deadly, you know, car crashes or getting bullied or, you know, dealing with racism, right? All these different traumatic experiences, you know, it can be really tough to just even talk about the subject.
Kaplash described suffering for years from chronic nightmares, insomnia, even hallucinations.
It's almost like your mind is like sending you little notifications through these like nightmares and flashbacks to address something kind of deep in yourself.
Before taking MDMA, Kaplash had to undergo several sessions of preparation therapy. And after his first dose, he says he was blindfolded and given headphones to help him block out his surroundings and fall into a meditative state.
While you're meditating, you get these like amazing visions that can really help you process the trauma because...
What do you mean by visions?
Ooh, yeah. So I guess like the way I would describe it is it's like you're living in an entirely new reality. It's like a dream, but you're like a lot more aware. Like you can, you're like conscious, you like fully remember it and you're like experiencing it as if you're like really living it, you know? Like it's almost hard to like tell between like, you know, reality and the actual vision to an extent.
This is actually pretty common. People who have taken MDMA often talk about being able to see themselves more clearly, with the ability to unpack their traumas without re-terrorizing themselves. Kaplash says he actually saw himself floating in space in front of a giant keyboard.
And it was so cool just because like each key was like a different part of my life. And I could see like different, you know, different memories in each one. So like one of the things that I'd always believed before I'd gotten into this treatment for a long time was that I was going to die like very, very early. Like, because, you know, when you have PTSD, right, when a lot of your life is, you know, kind of filled with traumas to an extent, it makes it hard for one to believe that you're actually going to live like a long, happy life. And so one of the, like, the most immediate thing that was kind of, that kind of shook me was that when you could, when I could see myself live past 40, when I could run down these piano keys and see myself live to like 60, 80, you know, doing all these things, living like a normal life to an extent, like that just shattered that belief entirely.
He was guided by his therapist to start exploring some of those traumatic memories.
So I immediately went to like the piano key where there was like those traumas. And I kind of like, this is going to sound weird, but like I dove into the piano key and then suddenly I was like transported to a new world. And like on this world, I was able to do a couple things. The first thing that I was able to do was first actually remember all the traumas. A big issue with PTSD is that often you can't even remember the entirety of the trauma because like parts of it are blacked out in your memory.
I can imagine this is why it's important to have a medical professional with you, because this is some heavy stuff.
Oh, yeah. When you're, because, yeah, because when you're living the same traumas over and over for like a thousand lifetimes, it's a lot.
Kaplash finished his three sessions in 2018 and now organizes mental health programs at his university.
You know, I'm kind of trying to figure out more who this new kind of person is. Because when you go through such kind of like life-changing therapy in such a short amount of time, you're kind of functionally a different person than who you were. And so kind of figuring out who you are in this new world has kind of been what I've been doing. And it seems to an extent that person is, you know, a very aggressive activist.
Kaplash is also now in regular talk therapy. This latest study of 90 participants produced no serious side effects. But before it can be approved for therapeutic use, the Food and Drug Administration needs a second positive phase 3 trial. That trial, which has about 100 participants, is currently underway and should be up for approval in 2023.
On NPR's Rough Translation,
there's just fewer people that know somebody that's in the military.
After 20 years of war, are civilians and military farther apart than ever?
They were asking me, do you want to hear this? Do you want to know us?
Listen to Homefront, the new season of Rough Translation.
In Texas, the fight over voting rights continues. Republican Governor Greg Abbott has threatened to withhold pay from the state legislature after Democrats walked out during a vote on Sunday in protest of a bill that would place restrictions on voting. On Morning Edition, Republican Texas State Representative Travis Clardy defended the bill, saying Texas is not trying to change its election rules based on former President Trump's lie that the election was stolen.
This is a preventative measure for us. We do have, and heard testimony throughout our session, of problems of voter irregularities, of voter fraud, of cases currently being investigated. It is an issue. It is a real thing. But I think it's our job to make sure that doesn't blossom into a problem that disturbs one of the underpinnings of our democracy, and that is confidence in our elections.
Let's bring in Ashley Lopez. She's senior reporter for KUT in Austin, and she's been covering this. And Ashley, is there any evidence behind what Republican State Representative Travis Clardy is saying, that there's been voting irregularities in Texas that warrant new election rules in the state?
You know, I find what he said really interesting, because actually in the first few weeks of the legislative session, which started earlier this year, state election officials, which are the folks that oversee elections in Texas, told lawmakers like Clardy explicitly that the 2020 election in Texas was both safe and secure. They said they found no large-scale problems with how elections are being run by local officials in the state. And I got to say, even when the governor first announced that he would ask lawmakers to pass bills that would make elections more secure in Texas, when asked, he said he couldn't identify any evidence of actual voter fraud in the state. So I think when Clardy says that this is like mostly preventative, the subtext here is that they were seeking out laws to fix a problem that could exist, but currently don't.
Let's break this down a little bit more. The bill, Senate Bill 7, had been going through a lot of changes since it was first introduced earlier this year. Yeah. Democratic State Representative Rafael Anchia actually told us yesterday on the show that Democrats walked out because there was additional language added on Saturday night without discussion. Governor Abbott said the bill will now be added to a special session. What are some of the key items of note in this bill, and how dramatically could it change going forward?
Well, it's important to point out this starts anew. And I will say early on, the governor and lawmakers said they really sought to address some efforts, particularly in the Houston area during the 2020 election, that made voting more accessible and safe during the pandemic. So like 24-hour voting centers and drive-through voting, those were things originally that Republicans wanted to outlaw. And those happen to be forms of voting, by the way, that were used predominantly by voters of color. And I feel like that's important to note. So I imagine those kind of things are going to be a starting point for the legislation because they were the most important things that were first brought up. But, you know, this legislative session that just ended was all over. Well, the process that this went through was all over the place. So many things were added, many were subtracted and then added out of nowhere again. And it's hard to imagine what other provisions are going to come up again or what new things we might see coming this time around. I mean, it's really hard to tell.
You know, I have just about 30 seconds with you. How does this political tension in Texas illustrate possibly the sentiment of Texas residents? What's the reaction to all of this?
Well, you know, Texans that I have talked to said they wished that a lot more focus of the legislative session was on coming out of the pandemic and that power grid issue that we faced, you know, early on in the year. So I think a lot these, you know, preventative and more like culture issues that are bringing up and just, you know, sort of red meat for the Republican base have frustrated some Texans is what I'm hearing.
Ashley Lopez, a senior reporter for KUT. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That it won't take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay. I'm sorry, my son, but too late in asking, Sister Peabody's coal train is hauled away.
If God's got a favorite songwriter, I think it's John Prine. That's how Kris Kristofferson described the late, great country folk singer who died last year from COVID-19. Prine's fans will recognize this track immediately. It's his most famous song, Paradise. And this version is sung by another great country singer, Sturgill Simpson. Simpson recently released this single for the upcoming John Prine tribute album, Broken Hearts and Dirty Windows Volume 2, which also features artists like Brandi Carlile. Our original studio quality recording for this interview failed, which is why you're about to hear Sturgill Simpson on a phone. But once he gets going telling stories about his old friend John Prine, we don't think you'll mind. Sturgill Simpson, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, John Prine wrote Paradise 50 years ago for his father, who was from Paradise, Kentucky. It's been covered dozens and dozens of times. What draws you to it?
I mean, it's one of those songs you've known your entire life, probably before you were too young to even know you knew it. We were in the studio recording Volume 1, Cutting Grass. So, you know, we had the band there. I think that was the first take, I think, is the one you just played. Because, you know, nobody had to learn it, if you know what I mean. Man, at that point, it was still fresh. I haven't really grasped that he's gone, just because there was no goodbye at all for anyone, especially his family members.
Well, for most of us, John Prine was like this legendary songwriter, but for you, he was that, but he was also your friend, right? I mean, what did he mean to you personally and as a musician?
Well, one, you have to get past the legend, because he was this unnervingly down-to-earth, extremely humble person. You know, but for me, the real enlightening perspective came from hearing him talk about, you know, his earlier life.
I always figured my music come from somewhere between here and Kentucky. We used to go down there as often as we could until the town got tore down by Mr. Peabody.
Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. Well, sometimes we travel right down the Green River to the abandoned old prison down by Avery Hill, where the air smelled like snakes and we'd shoot with our pistols, but empty pop bottles was all we would kill. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay.
You know, everybody says don't meet your heroes. I would say John Prine was definitely an exception to that rule.
So what was it like when you met him? Because you must have been starstruck.
The first time I met him, I was sitting in the studio at the butcher shop, probably actually late 2015, and I took a break, you know, hit the space bar and turned around. He was just sitting there. And I'll never forget it because he was wearing plaid pants and like a periwinkle blue linen cotton sport coat. He was just sort of sitting there listening, and he's just like, I'm hungry. Let's go get some lunch. And then he knew I just had a couple kids, so my house was full of energy and noise, and he had a little office there in the studio. We called it an office, but there's nothing in there but a jukebox and a pool table. And he said, you know, he had a set of keys made, so anytime you need a place. So we shared that room for the better part of 3 years, but we were never in the room at the same time. And all that time, I could see signs he'd been there, and likewise, and he'd usually like flip my drums upside down or move them around or something.
Really?
He's like every time it was always some little sign. But yeah, he, you know, when I got the news that he went into the hospital, I just sort of was standing outside and just kind of, accepted the fact that I probably was never going to see him again.
I'm sorry that you lost your friend and your hero. He was a hero to a lot of us. You're also from Kentucky and from a family of coal miners. I just wonder, you know, what that legacy, how that's inspired your own music and the way you think about things.
Immensely, especially on that topic. That song definitely connected with me at a very young age. I've written a couple songs about it.
I'll be one of the first in a long, long line not to go down from old black lung. Yeah, my death will be slower than the rest of my kind, and my life will be sadder than the songs they all sung. Well, now old King Cole, what are we gonna do when the mountains are gone and so are you?
My mother's father and her brother, all my grandfathers, great-grandfathers were coal miners, and so from outside looking in, there's the devastation and the lack of sustainability in terms of worshiping little black lumps of rock for energy. But when you live in those communities, or more importantly, let's say, for instance, my grandfather had a seventh grade education, but because he worked, you know, as a foreman, you know, with a seventh grade education, was making $90,000 to $110,000 a year, and that provided for our family in a way that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. And then now that those industries have sort of dried up and left, taking all the money with them and left the regional devastation, you know, those opportunities aren't there anymore, and there's none being brought in. So I guess for me, the lack of understanding, I guess, from outsiders, they want to know why the region is so hell-bent on the return of those jobs, is because it was the one thing that ever really brought sustainable income and outside of that opportunity, in a lot of ways, hope in Appalachia.
Yeah. Let's hear some more of your music. You came out with two albums late last year, Cutting Grass, Volume 1 and 2. This one is called Hobo Cartoon.
Wish I was riding steam train right out of pages of town, down through the old roaring 20s, for the fall of 1929. Back in the heyday railroad, before airplanes fluttered and flew, color me in like a cartoon hobo, doing what bums used to do.
You wrote that song with Merle Haggard, but he died in 2016. You gotta explain how that song came about.
That song, actually, Merle wrote the lyrics while he was in the hospital bed, probably knowing he was at the end of his life, and he was still writing songs. He was just laying there, and he sent me that song via text message, and it was from one railroader to another. And I was like, God, what am I going to do with this, you know? And then when this record came up, you know, I was like, well, now or never, this is sort of these are the records that this song belongs on.
What was it like for you to get a song texted to you from Merle Haggard on his deathbed? I mean, how did you feel about that? It's kind of an honor, isn't it?
It's an immense honor. But yeah, man, mostly I just miss these guys. It's tough. I feel like I've lost my grandfather 5 times, especially when you don't really get to say all the things you wish you had, or you're always too nervous to, or you didn't want to bother him when you're in front of him. You just, you know, you don't want to be that guy. So you just, a lot of times we just sit there and not saying anything. And then now I just wish, you know, I had one good opportunity to embarrass myself.
What would you say to him?
A bunch of stuff I'm not going to say on NPR. I don't know, man. I just probably just hug him and tell him thanks. You know, I love him, and I don't know. Stop smoking. Yeah. What a year. Jesus.
It's been rough. It's been rough. Sturgill Simpson, Grammy Award-winning singer and songwriter, thank you so much for speaking with us. It's been a pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Sturgill's version of Paradise on the John Prine tribute album is out now. The entire album, Broken Hearts and Dirty Windows Volume 2, will be available this fall.
Long before the pandemic, some rural communities struggled with poor access to healthcare, including dental care. And some areas are now trying to change that. A pop-up health clinic for underserved communities in Lyon County, Nevada, just launched a mobile dental service. Natalie Van Hooser of member station KUNR made the trip down to Yerington to learn more.
On an overcast Sunday morning, about 10 people line up in a parking lot in the rural town of Yerington. They're waiting for their appointments at the pop-up medical outreach clinic. The clinic, organized by the University of Nevada, Reno School of Medicine, sees patients once a month and provides health and dental services for people who can't afford them.
The fact that this is so easily accessible and that it's free makes it all the more comfortable to come to.
That's Yerington resident Darlene Marie Triplet, who says she relies on this health clinic. So does Sean Laughlin, who's here for a dental checkup in the 40-foot mobile van, which sits outside the medical building. He also lives in rural Nevada and drove about an hour to Yerington.
I need some work done on a tooth, and I was planning on going to my dentist in Mexico because it's a lot less expensive than here in America. And when I found out about this, I thought, well, I've got to give that a try. It sounds like something I'd be interested in.
Inside the unit, there are two patient rooms, separated by a waiting area. Drop-in Dental was started by dentist Veronica Vasquez. The majority of her work in the Reno area is with corporate clients, and she and her team of dental professionals and students volunteer their time in Yerington. Vasquez says the dental issues she sees in rural and urban Nevada are similar, but the lack of access to dental care in rural areas can present challenges.
When you start getting into an area of neglect and you don't have regular cleanings and your gums get inflamed, then you have bone loss. Loss of function with your teeth and not having biting surfaces is a health problem, right? Because you can't eat nutritional food.
Vasquez says this lack of dental care can exacerbate other serious health issues too.
There's a link between periodontal or gum disease and cardiac disease as well. So there's that medical oral link.
There are just 2 dental practices in Yerington, serving a population of more than 3,000 people. For those looking for additional care, the closest urban areas, Reno and Carson City, are over an hour away. For 2 years now, University of Nevada, Reno medical students have organized these free pop-up clinics in rural areas, including Yerington, providing services such as immunizations, blood work, and diabetes care. They coordinate with community organizations, including the Healthy Communities Coalition, a nonprofit which helps people in rural areas struggling with access to health care and food insecurities. Wendy Madsen heads up the coalition. She says she realized there was a vital need for dental care during a conversation she had with volunteers.
2 of our food pantry volunteers had come in to serve and had shared that the night before
They had pulled each other's teeth in their garage because they had infections and these painful teeth. So it really opened our eyes to what is happening, why, and what are we going to do about it.
To address this need, Madsen and her team worked to include Drop-In Dental's mobile services as part of the pop-up clinic. Madsen said the response was immediate.
We put out the information for the appointments, and it filled up in 2 hours. We have a wait list a page and a half long.
A recent study in the International Journal for Equity in Health found that mobile clinics can reduce barriers to health care in both rural and urban regions. These clinics visit areas that are typically underserved and lessen the need for transportation.
Mobile clinics have a history of developing deep relationships and trust with communities.
Molly Williams co-authored the study. She's a doctor of public health and the executive director of the Family Van, a mobile medical unit run by the Harvard Medical School. Williams says mobile medical units do more than provide physical access to care.
When done right, when developed with the community over time, mobile clinic operators can reach people who may not feel comfortable getting care through the traditional healthcare system.
And Williams applauds the inclusion of mobile dental care, which she says can provide additional health benefits.
Many dentists talk to you about your health history. And so it's a place where they can catch oral cancer early on. So making sure that we get people into all the types of health care, including dental care, is important for people's overall health.
Back at the mobile dental van, Sean Lachlan says he'd like to come back to this clinic.
I would love to do it again. It's nice to be welcomed into a situation where you don't have the anxiety of the heavy burden of cost.
And this summer, the University of Nevada, Reno medical students and community partners are planning outreach to another underserved group, migrant farm workers. For Here and Now, I'm Natalie Van Hooser.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.